This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
The movie reviews are available as a podcast, and that's why Mark Kermode is sitting opposite me right at this moment. Good afternoon to you, Mark.
Yes, it's lovely to see you again too, and I did have a terrific holiday. Thank you for asking.
How was your holiday, by the way?
Well, spoil only by the sound of you bad-mouthing me for ringing in the programme.
Oh, well, it happens all the time. Hey, and I'm delighted to say we've been joined by Wim Wenders, legendary film director. Wim, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Thank
you. To you both. You got me really worried about my pension now.
Oh, right. Oh, we got you worried on your pension. Well, all you need is a couple of successful movies, and I don't think you'll need to worry, sir.
Okay, I'm working on that.
Okay, so, Wim, I would think that, you know, how long does the money keep rolling in for, Wim? You know, when you've worked, when you have big, iconic movies like Paris, Texas and Wings of Desire, does the money sort of come in every single year? Does that, is that still an earner?
It is not really, because in not a, I mean, I own all these old films of mine, and you have to actually invest in order to keep them in shape. You have to make new masters. You have to restore the negative. In the long run, I mean, you have to. It's costing you.
Yeah. Let's talk about Don't Come Knocking, which hopefully will be a big earner for a few years to come. And you got some old friends in this film. What's it about?
Well, one old friend at least. That's Sam Shepard, with whom I did, in fact, write Paris, Texas a long time ago, but I never had him in front of my camera. A couple of other friends, Tim Roth, I worked with once before. That was great. A couple of new friends I made. Jessica Lang, I've known her for a long time, but never made a movie with her, and that was a great pleasure.
And she's the other half of Sam Shepard, is that right?
She's the better half of Sam Shepard.
The better half of Sam. And did you get to Jessica through Sam? That's the way these things work, I imagine.
Sam was the toughest obstacle to overcome because the two of them are married for almost 20 years, by now 20 years. And actually when they got married and had kids, they stopped working with each other because the deal was in the family, one of us stays home because Sam is really quite a responsible father, unlike Howard in the movie. So, and Sam made it clear to me that he wanted to play the lead in this film, and so when I said, I think Jessica would be terrific for Doreen, he said, oh yeah, because he can't have us both, because if I'm going to be Howard, remember, how can you have Jessica, because she's going to stay with the kids. Unless you want Jessica, then I stay with the kids. And luckily, it took us 3 years to write the script, and when the damn thing was finally done, the kids were out of school, so...
Fine.
I lucked out.
Now, so Sam Shepard is playing Howard Spence. Tell us about him and the kind of guy that he is, what he's up to.
Howard Spence is a hopeless guy, really. I mean, he's sort of a Don Quixote character in disguise of a cowboy. Because Howard Spence has lived his entire life in front of the movie camera. He's been playing Western heroes, and you could say that's an obsolete profession. I would say you're right. Because not many movies, not many guys can make their living being a Western hero. I mean, at a time, Gary Cooper and John Wayne, they made a living just playing cowboys. Howard Spence is one of the last who tries to make a living. And now I'm worried about his pension. But anyway, he's been a cowboy all his life and played these guys and really lived a life of sex and drugs and rock and roll and never worried much and never really had any commitment and run away from everything and was pursuing that great dream of eternal freedom until one day, and he's 60 now, he wakes up and he realizes in the movie of his own life he's not a hero, he's not even a supporting actor, he's a damn extra because he didn't happen in his life. So he sets out to find a trace of that life he never had.
So it is a fairly debauched life that he's running away from.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. He's been a womanizer all his life, and I mean he's one of those actors who really lived recklessly and stretched it. And one day he's 60 and realizes he can't really continue with that sort of life. There's no future, but then he realizes he also has no past.
Except that the past is catching up with him, isn't it? Jessica Lange plays Doreen, and he's had a fling with her in the past.
Yes, I mean, he's catching up with her in a strange way, because if he goes back to his old stomping grounds, and because he has heard a rumor from his mom that he might have a kid. So he's interested, because that child, I mean, maybe he's done something right in his life by gendering that boy who by now should be 30. So he goes back and finds the boy and finds his mother, and that is Jessica Lange, Doreen, and they both haven't seen Howard in 30 years. Actually, his son has never seen him, and Doreen isn't all that happy that he shows up, but then she thinks maybe it's good for the kid that he finally has a father. And, I mean, Howard is stupid enough and hopeless enough to propose to her, which is not exactly what ladies like when you come 30 years too late.
No. That's right. We start our conversation talking about old friends, and you have some old friends working on the soundtrack for this. And in fact, on U2.com at the moment, you can hear some of the music which Bono and Edge worked on.
Yeah, they came through miraculously with the title track for Don't Come Knocking. I mean, I showed Bono the movie a long time ago. It was in a rough cut on the editing table, and he said, I like it. And I didn't ask him, I swear to God, I didn't ask him. He, by himself, said, we might come up with a title track. And then I thought, oh, yeah, because I knew what he was up to. I mean, they were doing their big tour, the Vertigo tour, and he was, well, more of a politician than anything, working for Live Aid and the One Campaign, and whenever you wanted to reach Bono, he was either at the White House or seeing Chirac or Blair or whatever.
Must get you down, trying to get a hold of him.
It is difficult, I tell you. And, I mean, we're good friends, but I realized he had a lot of stuff on his slate. And so the movie was finally finished, and T-Bone Burnett had done the rest of the score, and there I was. Of course, I did not have a title track to end the movie on, and we showed the film in Cannes without a title track, because, I mean, how could Bono have done it? Because he was busy. Whenever I tried him, I said, I'm working on it, of course. So one day, the producer came to me and said, let's face it, it's a pipe dream. Let's just face it. We have to start making prints next week. The film is coming out all over the place. We're not going to have that title track. Forget dreaming about that. Mm. So then I said, okay, let's make prints on Monday. And Friday night, I swear to God, Friday night, I got an email with the longest attachment I ever had in my life. And that was from Edge. And it was the song. Only it wasn't the finished song. It was Bono's voice and Andrea from the chorus. They sing a duet. And it was heartbreaking, but the music was strictly temp music. Edge had done it on his computer, so I couldn't use it. I mean, it was two nights before I had to drop it into the mix. So I called T-Bone and I said, I'm going to send you a huge music file, and you better get the entire band and all the musicians back in the studio on the weekend and fill in that music so I can put it in the mix Monday morning before we go to Optical Track and make prints from Monday night on. And he said, you're out of your mind. I said, no, this is the only chance we have. So we did it. Monday morning, the music was finished, and it got into the film miraculously the last second when it was possible.
That is extraordinary. So T-Bone Burnett, of course, I mean, he'll be fairly soon up at that Bono difficult to get hold of status after the success of the Johnny Cash movie.
Oh, yeah, not only Johnny Cash. I mean, he's done Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which was already fantastic. Really fantastic score. He did a miraculous job on Walk the Line. I agree. He's done a lot of great soundtracks. And he's put his own light too much in the shadow, because he's also a great singer-songwriter himself. Although his last album as a singer-songwriter is 12 or 14 years back, The Criminal Under My Own Hat, which in my book is one of the greatest albums of the 90s.
We'll do some more with Vim Vendors in just a moment. In fact, Vim, some people are getting quite excited. The people tuned in sort of halfway through our pensions conversation and the beginning of conversation with you, and they think that your new movie is going to be on the subject of pensions.
Pensions, yeah.
Now,
fantastic. Well, you know, but they're going to be bitterly disappointed.
That could be extremely. Have pensions ever been used excitingly in a movie?
Excitingly? At all?
Maybe Tim Ross, as a bounty hunter, could go to come to England and take care of the pension plans.
Tim Roth being in charge of pensions.
It's not going to sell, is it, really?
I'd vote for that, actually.
But do you think you could get Bono to write a song about the pensions? I mean, that would sell it.
I don't think Bono's going to write the title track for that one.
Mark Comedy's here, Vim Vendors, in the BBC studios in Berlin. I think a couple of questions for you here, Vim, from listeners. Stevie in Glasgow says, Paris, Texas and Wings of Desire, two of my all-time favourite films. Can you ask Vim what his favourite film is amongst his large body of work?
I'm always scared about this one because as a film director, you feel towards your movies like some parents feel towards their kids. So you don't necessarily love the ones that are successful and that got out into the world and made it, but you're sort of still protective of your troubled children, so to speak. So none of his favorite I would quote as mine, because I mean those are great, and Wings of Desire, Paris, Texas, and Buena Vista Social Club, they did well and they don't need me anymore, but I'm worried about some of the other ones.
Chris in Farnham says, I recently managed to pick up the 3-disc DVD director's version of Until the End of the World from a source in Italy, a magnificent film which I go back to again and again. Is it true that there is an even longer version of the film somewhere, even longer than the 5-hour approximate copy that I have?
I'm not that bad. But right on, Chris. I'm happy you have that. And it's also now released in a couple of other territories. We just released in Germany. It's a beautiful version with some extra stuff. But I'm not intending to release an even longer version. But my initial rough cut, believe it or not, was 20 hours, wow. But nobody will ever see that.
I mean, Andy Warhol territory there, Mark.
It's interesting because I saw Don't Come Knocking at Cannes almost this time last year,
yeah.
And there was a peculiar coincidence that I saw that and Broken Flowers almost back-to-back, both of which concerned men at a certain point in their life discovering that they might have children and going back to find some kind of meaning for children. And obviously children have been, you know, important all the way through your movies, right back to Alice in the Cities and things. And I wonder how much you feel any of that autobiographical search for a purpose to your own life. Because it was very tempting to look at it and go, well, you know, that's what it's about. It's about searching for meaning in your own life.
Well, I don't think there's anything autobiographical in Don't Come Knocking. At least I'm very happy. I have nothing to do whatsoever with Howard. And I think the missing fathers are a big subject in our civilization, and the fact that they came up in several films cannot be a coincidence. I love Jim's film Broken Flower, but it's almost more of the Don Juan aspect of the story, that guy who had all these lovers and he meets all these women, and Howard is more of a Don Quixote guy. He's just fighting windmills. And actually, he meets his son, while the guy in Broken Flowers finally meets up with a kid.
Well, he may or may not be the son. The other thing I was wondering about is, because so much of your, I mean, almost all of your movies now, going back to, I don't know whether Summer in the City is available, but things like Kings of the Road, obviously, are all now available on DVD, so people can go back and go through your entire back catalogue. And whereas before, those films would perhaps have disappeared off into the ether, do you feel happy about the fact that people can still go and get Kings of the Road, can get Alice in the Cities, can look at your old work and reclaim it?
It's good, yeah. I love DVDs myself, and I have lots of films on DVD, and mostly films I've seen anyway. But it's good to be able to own them, and it's like books, and you can catch another chapter, or you can see the whole thing again, and you can hear the director's commentary, and you can check out what they cut out of the film. I love the DVD medium a lot.
Bim, it's been fantastic to have you on the program. Thank you for your time today. What are you working on next?
Nothing really. I've made 3 films back to back with Soul of a Man, Land of Plenty, and Don't Come Knocking, and it's all in America. And I'm now in Germany, and I'm sort of looking around and realizing I know Montana and Nevada much better than some of the new German states, and actually I'm going to stay here for a while, and I think I'll make a film in my own language after 12 years again.
Wim, thank you very much indeed for your time today.
It's been a pleasure, Mark.
Wim Wenders,
thank you. He said it's been a pleasure to me, not to you.
Yep.
Because he knew.
But he assumed that I was me and that you were you. And thank you very much to the listener who sent in a very strange photograph with Mark as Doctor Who and me as Billy Piper.
There's something really peculiar about the mind that did that.
He got the role slightly wrong as well. He's got the touch of the Wim Wenders.
The touch of the Vims, yes. You know, there's a lovely documentary about Wim Wenders, which you didn't mention, which called Motion and Emotion, the films of Wim Wenders, which came out about 10 years ago. And it starts off with Sam Fuller, you know, the famous director Sam Fuller, saying, "I just want to get one thing straight," because that's how he talks. "Are we going to say Wim or Vim?" And we never sorted that out.
Are we in an impressions Friday, are we? Because it's always a low point.
I've been told not to do it.
Excellent. Yeah. Amongst the movies coming up for insightful review, American Dreams.
Are you getting somebody else in, are you?
Yeah. No, of course not. Don't look hurt. Silent Hill. And do you say Crazy?
Crazy. We'll do crazy. Yeah, I know. I don't even entirely understand why it started.
Anyway, at 10, Humko Diwana Kargay.
Don't know, haven't seen it. But it must have been press screen because there is... Indian, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And but I will try and now catch it in the multiplex. I think it must have been press screen, but as you know, I've been off for 2 weeks.
The Shaggy Dog at number 9.
Tim Allen, he's great when he's doing Toy Story, isn't he? And after that, he's really not very great.
Failure to Launch at 8.
Just not funny, interesting, exciting in any way, shape or form. There is not a whole underclass of people who look like Matthew McConaughey out there living with their parents who require the special services of an agent to come in and pretend to date them to get them out of home. It's not a water cooler movie because no one's going to go and see it and then the next day say, "Hey, did you see that film about a topical social issue?" It's not an issue.
This might be a very shallow point, but is it a risk to put the word failure in the title of a film? Anyway?
Well, of course, and the other thing about Failure to Launch is that when I saw the title of it, I didn't think it was about that. I thought it was about something altogether different. And when it says Failure to Launch with Matthew McConaughey, I thought, wow, he's really going out on a limb with that. But then it wasn't about that at all.
I am still intrigued as to whether pensions have ever been used in any cinematic. I mean, clearly Vim might actually, having slept on that conversation, think... maybe I shall return to the pensions issue in my next German film.
It's entirely possible. Das Pensiones. No, that's Spanish, isn't it? If anybody knows, and I'm sure they do, please email us in and it'll become glaringly apparent.
Chris, on this text, says, Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, yeah.
They use pensions.
Pension plans, yeah.
Do you trust your wife? That kind of
Yeah,
thing.
Actually, that's very good. That's very good. And I should have got that having written a book about Shawshank and made a documentary about it.
So, okay, so if there's any better use of pensions, we'll take your suggestions. Alien Autopsy at 7. That's the Anton Deck film.
Yeah, it's neither as bad nor as good as it could be. The main problem with it is it's not as good as the trailer. When I saw the trailer, I laughed out loud and I thought, terrific, this is a great idea. And it isn't a great idea, but it sort of runs out of steam. But it's not awful. It's not great. It's a bit of a mess, but it's
not. Is it
not
as good
awful.
As the trailer?
No, it's not as good as the trailer. Didn't I just say that?
Yeah, well, you said that
it's neither as.
You said that, but not in as pithy a way.
Okay, it's not as good as the trailer, which is great, but it's not terrible. And, you know, Anton Deck, who are, as I think James King was saying when he reviewed it, they are completely mutually compatible and you don't know which is which, but they always have to stand left and right. At least somebody told me that's true. I know who told me that. Mark Lawson told me that was true. But they are actually playing characters in this film, although in the end those characters are Anton Deck.
We'll do some correspondence once we've done the top 10, otherwise we'll never get there. An American Haunting at 6.
It's a film made by somebody who sat down and watched every horror film of the last 30 years, and I'll do a little bit of that. And it's based on an allegedly true story of the Bell Witch, but it's really... it's not based on anything other than a bunch of horror films that this guy... So there are a couple of scary moments, but they're all taken from The Exorcist and Abby and all... I mean, it's really, you know, girl bothered by ghost does a lot of rolling around on bed whilst Donald Sutherland looks on in a slightly angst-ridden manner. It's just that it's set in like the setting from The Village. Not awful, but not much good.
She's the Man at 5.
Haven't seen it. James was kind of moderately thumbs up about it,
wasn't
he?
Well, I'll give you...
Seen it? Okay.
No, I'll give you my daughter's review.
Gone.
It's the best film ever.
Okay, but your daughter thought that about The Parent Trap.
Yeah, absolutely. It's better than that.
Is it better than The Parent Trap?
Better than Parent Trap.
Fine. Yeah. Well, I'm not going to argue with it because, you know.
It was absolutely fantastic.
Did you see it?
No.
Because you now go to the movies and listen to the sports news on your...
That was a few years ago. I now no longer have to accompany my children to the films. And She's the Man was one of those. I said, no, I'm happy to rely on your opinion.
That's going on the poster, the best movie ever made, Radio 5.
Take the lead at number four.
Again, sorry, off 2 weeks of holiday and I've missed almost everything that's been
up to do.
I have.
Inside Man at 3.
But you know, I think I was going to say about Take the Lead is it's inspired by Mad Hot Ballroom, the documentary, which was great. And I think it's going to be hard pressed to have the charm of that. Then, you know, you never know.
Inside Man at 3?
Intelligent, smart heist thriller from Spike Lee with much less politics than you'd expect from a Spike Lee movie. But as he said when he was on the show here, you know, he is now working on the Hurricane Katrina documentary. And incidentally, the conspiracy theories around the Hurricane Katrina stuff are growing by the day. Because Spike, as you remember, he said on the show that some people in his doc said that they believed that the levees were bombed.
Yeah, his wife is convinced of this.
His wife is convinced that the 9/11 thing was, you know, was all a bit of a put-up, apparently. And incidentally, if you want to know about 9/11, ask Charlie Sheen. Because, boy, he has a lot to say about the 9/11 conspiracy theories.
As if we're ever going to be bumping into... I mean, how practical and useful is that as advice? Well, if you want to know about something, ask Charlie Sheen.
No, listen, believe me.
I'm never going to ask him.
The way he is being at the moment, you could probably get him to return your phone call if you said, I need to talk to you, it's about 9/11 conspiracy theories. There's a whole thing on the web
about... Does he believe them or not?
There's a whole thing on the web about how I am in the pay of some fascist organisation because I refuse to take Charlie Sheen's claims about 9/11 seriously. Well, hey, I'm sorry.
I'm sure Martin must be very proud of his son. Where are we? A Scary Movie 4 at 2.
You know, it's more of the same, but it's less of the same.
At number 1, Ice Age 2, The Meltdown.
Which is a series of funny interludes with nothing vaguely resembling a plot. And Pixar know how to do plots. And Ice Age 2 knows how to do gags, and the gag with the little rodenty thing knocking the acorn into the side of the glacier. Yeah, it's funny. It doesn't tie up with any of the rest of the film about the large, big, hairy animal and the sea beasts, but it's just a collection of bits.
Which is awful.
Okay.
It's another subject of best use of pensions in a movie. Yep. Andrew Manchester, how about the Annuityville horror?
That's very good.
It's not bad.
Does he mean the original or the remake?
I really couldn't care. It's 3:39 on the subject of pensions in movies.
Yeah.
Tarek in Birmingham, actually, this is a good one. The Negotiator, because the whole thing was based around a pension scam.
Yes, you're quite right.
Where the whole thing was stolen and that made...
Yeah, very good, very good.
Very angry about
it. Very high class of listener, really,
and,
isn't it?
And like this from Liam, on the subject of pensions in films, basically anything Steve Martin's been in over the last 5 years.
Because it's all to do with his pension plan.
That's all he's bothered
very
about,
good.
In the opinion of Liam.
Except for Shop Girl, which he would tell you is, in fact, his artistic soul being revealed, and in which case, you know,
let's not look
put
at
it away, Steve.
Okay, amongst the new releases, we can. It's always nice to have a Hugh Grant film.
It is American Dreams. Before I saw this, I had read. Sorry to invoke his name twice in one show, but Mark Lawson had written a piece in one of the newspapers, I think The Guardian, saying that suicide bombers were like the unspoken pariah of cinema, and whereas before it had been things like child molesters, suicide bombers were the least, but in fact there had now been a number of movies about them. And he said in passing that American Dreams was perhaps the bravest mainstream comedy ever made. I think he said it with tongue slightly in cheek. It is extraordinary in that it is a mainstream comedy by the director of American Pie, whose central plot point is that a suicide bomber is sent to America to wreak havoc and by a strange quirk of fate ends up becoming a contestant on American Dreams, which is an American pop idol-like program presided over by Hugh Grant playing a character not dissimilar to Simon Cowell. And on this particular tournament, one of the guest judges is going to be the President of America, played by Dennis Quaid in a manner not dissimilar to President George W. Bush.
Quite believable so far.
And you don't have to be a genius also to figure out who the President's advisor, played there by Willem Dafoe, is based on either.
This is kind of a Dick Cheney character,
yeah.
Is it?
It's very, very free. There's, funnily enough, one of the funniest lines in the movie is that we see the American President reading something, and his advisor comes in and says, you've got to come and make a speech. He says, no, I've started reading newspapers, and it's incredible. Like, there's so much of interest in them.
He's reading
The Guardian. Yeah. That's right. So you wonder, that's a fantastic piece of product placement there. So, now,
is that why Mark Lawson likes it?
Well, yes, I think they may. No, no, of course not.
I just meant, you know, hey, how many movies has The Guardian been in?
Well, exactly. How many movies has The Guardian been in with somebody reading it saying, I'm sorry, I can't come and address the nation because there's so much interesting stuff in this? Now, look, here's the thing. As I've said a million times before, in the Spinal Tap quote, which is, you know, as true as anything Shakespeare ever said, there is a very thin line between clever and stupid. And in the case of American Dreams, firstly, on the obviously good front, Hugh Grant is very good as the Simon Cowell-like character. Willem Dafoe is very funny as the president's advisor. Dennis Quaid is very funny as the president, who's completely illiterate, but then discovers reading and just can't get over the joy of realizing that it's possible to find things out that you weren't told by your advisor. So there are, you know, very good performances in it, comedy performances. It's interesting, incidentally, that Hugh Grant has now almost exclusively settled down to playing slime ball roles. The way in which he's successful is that he plays Lucius. He plays characters who are lovable but hateful at the same time. It's very much the kind of the Bridget Jones character that he plays has taken over. And because you think when he started out in his career, he was meant to be the lovable one. He was meant to be the bumbling one in Four Weddings and a Funeral, who you liked. He was a little bit of a cad, a little bit of a rake. But actually, more and more, he's gone into this slimy area. And it's very interesting that he is very, very good at doing slimy. And I think he's a very fine comic actor. And I would much rather see somebody who is at ease with their dark side in the way that he is than, for example, Steve Martin, who doesn't have a dark side to speak of, to quote When Harry Met Sally. Okay, so all those things good. However, it is this very strange, edgy thing about a suicide bomber going to America, ending up on an American reality TV show, and it being from the director that it's from. It's one of those movies that you think, now, either you are being very, very brave, very satirical, very out there, you're making some, or you have misjudged this so badly that your subject matter is going to flatten the movie. And the really interesting thing about American Dreams is you never really know which of those two is true, even when it gets to the end. I won't give away the ending at all, but suffice to say that to some extent what you expect will happen, but to some extent what you don't expect will happen also happens, and it has...
Oh, that's clear.
No, but exactly, because I don't want to give it away, but to say it doesn't just tie up all its loose ends in a nice, neat, happy families thing. Obviously, the moral of the story is, hey, why can't we all just get along, and why can't we all be nice to each other? But to have made the movie addressing this issue at this particular time... I mean, at a time when...
And in a week when there has been a suicide bombing in Israel.
Exactly.
So does that make for a very uncomfortable...
It is uncomfortable,
moment.
But it knows it's uncomfortable. It's deliberately uncomfortable. I mean, if it has a flaw, and it does, it is that it is, in the end, too soft and too unstructured and too messy around the edges to really, really hit home. What you have is a kind of likeable comedy with an extremely dark, rancid thing at the centre of it. And if you took that extremely dark, rancid thing out, it would just be a likeable, dopey comedy about American reality TV programmes. And I'm very happy to see Hugh Grant taking the mick out of Simon Cowell. But it does have this other dimension just because of its subject matter. And I mean, I sat next to James King watching it. I felt uncomfortable from beginning to end.
Because you were sitting next to James?
Because I was sitting next to James, and also because of the subject of the film. And I have to say that I think that that is probably its strength, but I suspect it is also the thing that will stop it from being a huge hit.
This is Five Live. The latest suggestion, which has just turned into a stream of gags now, from Sean about pensions in movies.
Yeah.
Isa Cold in Alex.
Oh, very good. Yeah.
Ice, capital I.
I got it, yeah.
it's as good as we've got just at the moment. What is it that we do?
Well, this. I mean, you know.
this? So you're presenting unedifying meal to somebody.
All around the world, people are saying, what exactly is it that they do?
I've got no idea. Ronan on this. Simon, can you ask Mark if he was cuckolded into defending Basic Instinct 2, which he knows has just disappeared from the charts, in light of his wife's glowing two-page review of said film in this month's Sight and Sound? According to RottenTomatoes.com's ranking, it features in the top 15 worst-reviewed films so far this decade.
Yeah, but that's just because it's reviewed by idiots.
Ah.
I mean, the fact of the matter is, people who know what they're talking about, me, Nigel Floyd, Linda Ruth Williams, think it's a really interesting, funny...
That's your wife. You
yeah.
Just, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Think it's great. Yeah, but, you know, she's a writer for Sight and Sound.
Me.
No, but I'm sorry, you brought it up.
I was just reading
and
anyway.
And we happen to be right. In fact, no, there was somebody else emailed in, said, you know, is that actually you writing under a pseudonym? Because Linda had saw the film long before I did, because erotic thrillers is her pet subject. So, in fact, if anyone has ripped anyone off, I have ripped her off. But only simply because she's right in this case. I mean... You know, that's it. Jonathan Rutter once said that...
I wasn't criticising your wife, by the way.
No, I know. Rutter once said that me and Nigel Floyd tend to write our reviews by committee. No, we don't. We're just right, and the rest of you are just wrong. And I'm sorry, there we go.
Pensions in movies, Andy in Leeds. How about Love Actuary?
Is this going to go on for a long time?
No, it'll finish in 10 minutes.
Okay.
Unless Drive want to pick up and run with it.
Okay.
See what they do with it. And last one from Colin, Pep Sematary.
Pep Sematary, yeah. That'd be a better movie than Pet Sematary, though.
American Dreams is out. What else is new?
Tristan and Isolde, or I suppose to give it its correct title, Tristan plus Isolde, because it's like, you know, Romeo plus Juliet. Yep. Tristan plus Isolde. Dark Ages version of Romeo and Juliet, of course. Endless ongoing war between the English and Irish. You may know this story anyway. Tristan, played by James Franco. Nice cheeks. Not a whole lot else going on, but nice cheeks. Believed dead, put in a burial boat, sailed off the English coast, arrives in Ireland, where he is revived by Isolde, who is the daughter of the ruler who, with whom the English are at war. She revives him back to health, but then realises that he must go, because if her father finds him on Irish soil, he shall be torn limb from limb. And yet, in the small amount of time they spent together, love has blossomed. The enchanting voice of Sophia Myles, who I actually like very much. I liked her very much as Lady Penelope in the Thunderbirds movie, which I was singularly alone in defending, whilst everybody else got it wrong. But again, if you have kids and they've seen the Thunderbirds movie, you'll know that I was right. It's very entertaining and bears up many, many viewings, and her performance in that is very fine. She's actually the best thing in Tristan and Isolde. This was a long-time pet project for Ridley Scott. He was going to do it immediately after The Duelists, and as you know, even when his movies aren't great, Ridley Scott does remain a visionary director. He has an extraordinary way of creating whole new worlds, whether it's the world of Blade Runner or the world of Alien or the world of Kingdom of Heaven, you know, he's, or Gladiator. That's what he does. Sadly, didn't end up directing it, ends up producing it, and the directing chores went to Kevin Reynolds. Now, you remember him because he was the guy who directed Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, that incredibly historically accurate tract in which, as we've said on several occasions, they land at the White Cliffs of Dover in the morning.
Along Hadrian's Wall to Nottingham.
To Nottingham, where they arrived by tea time. And of course, in the world of Robin Hood, everyone dresses like a goth and has a feather cut and sings along to Bryan Adams songs. Well, all that historical authenticity has been brought to bear on the story of Tristan and Isolde, which, despite the fact that it's set in the Dark Ages, includes the line, "Why does loving you feel so wrong?" which I'm sure they never said that sort of thing in the Dark Ages. It also includes quotations from John Donne. Now, unless I missed a meeting, I don't think John Donne was around in the Dark Ages.
How are you defining the Dark Ages, by the way?
Well, the period before John Donne was around.
Just carry on, I'll just look it up.
Okay, fine. I think John Donne was 17th century. Anyway, and also, there's this absolutely...
He used to do Drive on Radio 2, yeah?
Did he? John Donne?
Yeah, before he was replaced by Johnny Walker.
Oh, yes, I think he did, yeah. And there's also this absolutely lovely moment in which Tristan, our hero, says...
1572 to 1631...
I don't think John Donne...
I think that might just be after the Dark Ages by a couple of years. But
I think so. I think he doesn't really count, does he?
Anyway,
can I move on?
Yes, absolutely.
There's a lovely moment in which Isolde says to Tristan, you know, the problem with our romance is that there's never going to be any picnics. And again, picnics? When's this set?
Do I have
exactly?
to look that up as well?
No, you don't. So... on the good side, Sophia Myles is a very fine actress. I hope that she finds better material than this. She has real screen presence and she gives it her best. On the bad side, it just stodges along. It isn't Romeo and Juliet, even though it wants to be Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet. It's got a sweeping score that attempts to fill in the gaps left by the script. But most damningly, it has in its hero, this incredibly bland guy, who you just think, I'm actually not really... convinced that a character as interesting as Sophia Myles' Isolde is meant to be would go to the ends of the earth to be with this bloke. In fact, the love rival, the person that she ends up marrying, is far more interesting. You know, dark haired, strange, only has one hand, interesting character. Really, I'd end up with him. So, fundamental, problematic flaw that there's not much chemistry between the leads. But I do think Sophia Myles is good, and I hope that she winds up in better stuff than this in the future.
We still have one other...
Well, can I knock two on the head very quickly?
You can do what you
if
want.
If that's all right.
That's clearly, it's your show.
Okay, fine. Thank you, Doctor. Silent Hill, latest adaptation of a computer game, directed by Christoph...
So automatically we know you're not going to like it because it comes from a computer game.
Well, that's...
That's what you've always said.
It is. You are both right and wrong. It is true that I've always said that the problem with computer games is that they don't have any stories. They don't. I mean, computer games are not about narrative. They're about plot. They're about bits of things bolted together in interactive fashion. They do not have narratives as such. They have plots.
What's the difference between narrative and plot?
Well, how long have you got? Plots
well,
and plot...
We're off air in 4.5 minutes.
Okay, fine. Plots is a whole bunch of things. It plot points, events, stuff happening. Narrative, or let's call it narrative arc, is an evolution of a narrative over a certain period of time.
That'll
when you play a computer game, you can give it a narrative arc, but it doesn't have it itself. In the case of Silent Hill, which is a story about a mother who, for reasons which are frankly inexplicable, takes her very disturbed child to a haunted town where she thinks she's going to get better, and then chases her around a whole bunch of rooms, demons, stuff, has to remember complicated instructions for no reason at all, other than, well, it's, you know, we're on level 3 now. Now we've got to go to level 4, now we've got level 5. About two-thirds of the way through, the movie actually stops, and there's a long plot exposition moment in which somebody does all the backstory, because up until that point, we haven't really had any narrative. Directed by Christoph Gantz, who has real style, written by Roger Avery, who won an Oscar for co-writing Pulp Fiction with Quentin Tarantino, throws everything and the kitchen sink at the screen, looks great, means nothing, totally empty, really annoying, absolutely doesn't move forward in any way, shape or form, and stands in line with Super Mario Brothers and Street Fighter and Doom and Lara Croft Tomb Raider and Mortal Kombat, all those films that are based on computer games that, I'm sorry, don't have story. Can we draw a line under this now? Can we just stop it?
Is that rhetorical, or is that you demanding?
No, it's a demand.
The Dark Ages, by the way, considered by some to start in 410 and by others in 476. Mm. So they kind of missed John Donne by about 1,100 years.
Mm.
But apart from that, I'm not, you know...
No, I know. It's no more historically inaccurate than the hairstyles, frankly.
So it doesn't matter that much.
So, film of the week, Crazy, or C-R-A-Z-Y, if one wants to call it. Can't play a clip from it because it's a French-Canadian film. And I have to say, it arrived with the fantastic publicity blurb that said, huge hit in Canada, has been seen by almost everyone in Quebec. Now, saying that a film has been seen by almost everyone in Quebec is not necessarily a good thing. It's rather like saying it was the biggest hit in Bratislava that year. I mean, you know, I like the Quebecians or whatever it is they're called.
Quebecois.
Is that what they're called?
I believe so.
Fine. But I don't know that saying, hey, everyone in Quebec gave this a thumbs up is necessarily a big come on. It's a coming-of-age movie directed by Jean-Marc Vallée. It's an episodic, not episodic, epic story of a family ruled over by a father who is besotted by Charles Aznavour and, of course, by Crazy, the song Crazy, which is, I don't know why it's C.R. Is that how the title of the... of the Patsy Cline song is written? I thought it was just Crazy.
I think it is just Crazy.
Yeah, so
I could look it up, but with 2 minutes to go...
No, don't quite get the acronym thing. An awful lot of it, although not all of it, an awful lot of it is set in the 1970s, and it's so, for one thing, it has a great nostalgic charm for me, great use of pop music, David Bowie, for example, Pink Floyd, and I admit that being a man of a certain age, that obviously has a pull on my heartstrings. Some people have criticised it, saying it is the least gay movie ever made, and therefore it is a movie that is embarrassed about its sexuality. No, it isn't. It's a movie that's not about being gay, it's a movie about being confused about your sexuality, and the movie is confused about its central character's sexuality, and that's perfectly fine. And would people please stop dictating what the sexuality of movies ought to be, and don't even start me on Cheesecake and Beefcake, because I've had too many rants about this to go into. The other thing about it is, which is notably absent from most of the coverage of it, is the film has a strangely spiritual dimension. The central character is born on Christmas Day and is believed by his mother to be able to perform miracles, and during his adolescence, in which his sexual identity is up for grabs, his relationship with his religion becomes particularly fraught. There are great dream sequences, one absolutely lovely moment in which our hero levitates in a church to the sound of Sympathy for the Devil, you know, the Rolling Stones song being sung along by these angelic choir boys, and yet it doesn't seem pretentious or posy or out of place. You just think it's part of the flow and the tapestry of the film itself. A really, really interesting, insightful, intelligent piece of work that I think has been somewhat underrated by people who want it to be more of a political tract.
And that's the movie of the week.
It is.
Don't forget the podcast. If you'd like to have Mark with you every single day of the week, the...
And who wouldn't?
The film review... How long have you got? So the film reviews are available as a podcast. This programme is available as a podcast. Details on the website. You can see Mark on News 24... pretty much doing the same thing as he's just done.
But with more waving arms.
Yeah. Every Friday from 5:45, it's repeated at 9:45. You are a tart. And final...
Look who's talking!
And final... as
Mr. Film. Pot, have you met Mr. Kettle?
Final pensions in a movie from David Telford, Tess of the D'Urbervilles.
Very good.
We'll leave it there. Have a good weekend. See you Monday.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.